Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the oil crash and you. You know, with an income of $50,000 a year, you pay $7,650 in Social Security taxes, well, if you're self-employed and paying 15.3%. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 that you paid Social Security from your $50,000 income? And then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of that $50,000 twice. But the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax, and then they make you pay 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax. Now that means that you pay 17% of $7,650 twice. And that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from you and everyone else that pays this tax. Now, what would you think if Sears Pennies or your credit card company charged you twice like Social Security and the IRS does? I thought you'd think that's just kind of special. For more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about energy and energy policy. I got a letter here from, actually I got a report from a fellow by the name of Tate, and he was good enough to send this report. He's in the oil business himself, and he said that the oil companies are understating the reserves. Now, they tell us in such journals as the National Geographic that we have about a trillion barrels of oil available. It's called proven reserves. It's what we know that we've got. Now, Tate here takes exception to that, sent me a report with a number of sources and says, no, it isn't a trillion barrels. Now, a trillion barrels at today's consumption would be about a 50-year supply. One of the most shocking things that we've discovered so far in the series is that we're consuming oil at about 22 billion barrels a year, but we're only discovering new oil to replace that at the rate of 6 billion barrels, or about 25%. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that isn't going to go on forever. Now, all of my life, we've been told that we're running out of oil. Well, that makes sense. The oil companies don't want to tell you that there's a never-ending supply. They want to keep jacking up the price. So that's just good marketing and merchandising on their part. Somewhere out here, though, there has to be some truth. Now, I've done a little reading here and there, and they tell us that we have about a 1,000-year supply of coal here in the United States. 1,000-year supply of coal. That's pretty good news. Then they tell us that we have about 3.7 trillion barrels of oil here in the United States locked up in oil shale. Now, of course, I don't know how much coal we have, and I don't think you do either. And I don't know any more than what I read in U.S. News or some other technical publication, but we call these people experts. And the experts are giving us these numbers and telling us, well, this is about where we're at, and here's what you can expect. And then we base our lives around that, don't we? Now, I pointed out to you that there were 10 sources of energy. There may be more, but generally we have coal. We burn a lot of that in our power plants to generate electricity. We have oil, and we burn a lot of that in power plants to make electricity. We have nuclear power. They produce about 20% of our energy, electrical energy here in the United States, and we have hydropower in our dams. Then we have some wind power and solar. That's kind of experimental, but I've seen some of these big wind farms out in California. PG&E has some wind farms up in Tehachapi, for instance, in the Tehachapi Mountains in the pass up there. And I've seen some in Colorado and as I travel around, and that's pretty impressive, and that's renewable. I mean, you know, you're just out here sucking up the wind, and you can't beat that with a club. It's probably not as dependable as burning coal, because if the wind doesn't blow for a day, well, you don't have any electricity, and you've got a power grid, and after all, the power grid has to be cranked up to full power all the time, 24 hours a day or nearly so. But the moral of the story is, if you got a power grid, and when the electricity is coming from the wind, you don't need to burn as much coal, do you? I mean, you can slack off on those power plants. Now, we here in America, we're mesmerized by giant size. You know, we like to see Hoover Dam or Lake Powell or Lake Mead. You know, we like to see these big lakes and giant power projects and Grand Coulee Dam. It doesn't occur to us that we could generate a lot of electricity in this country with little small power plants. Let me give you an illustration. When I was a kid, like I mentioned this last program, there were 237 mills in Humboldt County producing lumber. Well, in the early days, there were thousands of people that owned all of that timber. Then, little by little, the lumber companies bought the little guys out. Well, after all, the little guys wanted to sell. And the little guys sold and then went to work for the big companies. We called that employment. Today, those big companies employ very few people to produce the lumber that they produce, and the little guys that sold out to the big timber interests, the big timber companies, don't own the timber, don't own the land, they're landless peasants, and they're either unemployed or doing something else now. I think we were better off under the plan that Moses gave us out at Mount Sinai, where everybody owned a little bit of land. And instead of having a big corporation own tens of thousands of acres, you know, like J.R. Simplot owns thousands of acres of potatoes, wouldn't we be better served if we had a few thousand guys that owned a few hundred acres rather than a few hundred guys that own the thousands of acres? I think we'd have a better distribution of wealth, and I think we'd have a better distribution of power, political power, economic power, and ultimately electrical power. Because, you know, I'm a little small landowner, and I don't do it, but I could generate about 50 kilowatts of electricity here forever. That's how much wood I have, and that's how much wood is available for a little steam power plant. Last year, about 2 million acres of forest burned up, and we spent $3 or $4 billion putting those fires out. Wouldn't we be better served to burn that wood and generate electricity? Or to take those 2 million acres of forest that burned up, cut it up for lumber and cut it up for firewood and heat houses than we would to burn up these forests and pay billions of dollars to put the fires out? You know, just my common sense says to me that if we were to manage this a little better, I think that it would make more sense. Now, after all, well, we only have two methodologies by which to manage all of this wealth: the free marketplace, number one, the market, or central planning. Now, the free marketplace comes from God and the Bible, the Ten Commandments: free markets, property rights, limited government, strict liability in God. And then communism gives us the 10 planks. That's what we practice: central planning, the abolition of property, world government, evolutionary philosophy. Of course, we have insurance to go along with that. Now let's take a look at a couple more of these. We looked at oil and nuclear, and let's talk about hydroelectric, electricity. They say that hydroelectric is not a very good replacement. As a replacement for oil, very small compared with 40% provided at present by oil. And hydroelectric is unusable for aircraft and presents 722 million existing vehicles. I guess that's 722 million vehicles worldwide. Well then, if hydroelectric power is not available to run our cars, and oil is, then doesn't it make sense to stop burning oil to make electricity and to build more dams to make electricity out of hydropower? Now, God gave us the planet Earth, and he told us to dress it and keep it. He said, use it, but use it wisely. So I take a look at these two big dams on the Colorado River. Now, maybe there's three or four, but I see these two big ones. And I was driving down Highway 40. I mentioned this to you last time. Highway 70, I guess it was, through Colorado. And I noticed all kinds of places where you could put a little dam across. And in the old days, you know, around the turn of the century, for instance, up in Atlanta, Idaho, little town, little mining town up in Atlanta, they built a dam across the Boise River. Yeah, Boise River up in Atlanta is not very big. You know, you can walk across it. But they built this dam across there, and they had a power plant below it, and they could generate. Well, they had two great big generators in there. I don't know. Big sluice box. You know, the sluice box is about 3 feet wide and probably 4 feet deep. And the water that came out of it went into two big pipes. Well, the pipes were probably 3 feet in diameter and went down around these two generators. And it powered all of Atlanta. They had 5,000 people up there at the time running those mines up until 1937. So here's my point. Here's the Boise River up in Atlanta generating electricity for 5,000 people. Now, that river falls. You know, the head, they called that in that river, is only 30 feet from the top of the dam where the water came out to the bottom of the dam was about 30 feet. So they had 30 feet of head, 3 feet in diameter. Well, you know, every 40 feet of drop down that river, you could put a dam in, couldn't you? And every time you put a dam in, you could use that same water that went through that hydropower plant. And when the river drops 40 feet, let's say a mile down the river, you could put in another power plant and use the same water to generate enough power for another 5,000 people and then a mile. You know, by the time you go 80 miles down the river from Atlanta to Boise, and you put one dam in every mile, you could probably put a dam in closer than that. Let's just put a dam in every mile. Let's see how many feet that is. Atlanta's at about 5,000 feet elevation, and Boise's at 2,500. So you got 2,500 feet of drop. So if we have 2,500 feet of drop, then every 40 feet of drop, we could generate enough power for 5,000 people out of that river. And of course, the further down the river you go, the more tributaries are coming into it. And then you get a bigger and bigger river as you go down, so you could do even more. But just using the amount of water that comes up at the headwaters, way up there, you know, 2,500 divided by 40 would be 62 dams. Let's be reasonable, and let's just put in 50 dams times 5,000 people. And that would be enough power out of that river for 250,000 people in that 80 miles from Atlanta down to Boise. Furthermore, you would have 50 lakes in there full of fish for people to fish in. Now, the environmentalists tell us that we've got to have more outdoor recreation room. We got to have more wilderness and wild spots and parks. Well, you know, every time you put in one of those dams, you know, like Lake Mead, you got this giant dam, you got this giant lake. What's wrong with having 50 little power plants rather than one big one? Now, down at Lucky Peak, they got a big one, and at Arrow Rock, they got two big dams, two big lakes. And they don't generate any power off of either of them. They use that for irrigation. Seems like to me that instead of standing in the way of hydro development, I was talking to Helen Chenoweth here, and she used to work with Vern Ravenscroft putting in little power plants on creeks and streams, not just big rivers like the Boise River, but little creeks. And as I was going up to Atlanta one day, talking about hydropower here, there used to be a motel up there, and this motel was taking water out of a spring, out of the side of a hill that was about, I'd say, 500-700 feet up the side of a mountain. And it ran down and ran into the Boise River. Well, they took a 2-inch pipe, about 600 feet of head on a 2-inch pipe, and produced all of the electricity for that motel and store out of a little hydro plant. How many of those little hydro plants could you put in the United States? I tell you, you could put in thousands and thousands of them. And Helen Chenoweth, who used to be a member of Congress, did that for a living. She and that Vern Ravenscroft used to put those little power plants in all over Idaho, all over the West, not just in Idaho. And she said the biggest problem they had in putting those in was environmentalist and government regulation. It's not that we can't do it. It isn't that we can't produce the power. You've just got all of these roadblocks and hassles that you got to get over. Why do we want to put all of these roadblocks and hassles? Oh, God, we got to protect the environment. Well, okay. What is it about the environment that you need to protect that you can't use the water on the Boise River, you can't use the water coming down a creek, dam it up, make electricity, and put some fish in the pond behind the dam? What is it that's so damaging about that? Somebody said, well, it isn't a wild river. Why do you want a wild river? How many wild rivers do we need? You know, if you have to have a wild river or two, okay, let's put some wild rivers aside for the environmentalists so that they can have their wild rivers. And then can the rest of us dam up our rivers so that we can have electric power? Would that be all right? Then both of us would have what we want. You want a wild river? Well, now you take that Colorado River where it goes through the Grand Canyon. I don't know how many feet of drop there is in the Colorado River. I just know that about every 40 feet of drop you can generate electricity, and it would seem like to me that that would be the logical thing to do, a lot of little dams instead of one or two or three big ones. Now on the Columbia River, you got a big river, so you got to have some pretty big dams. And there's a lot of power comes off the Columbia River. I don't see why we can't develop more little power plants. They talk about, well, we've used up all of the major sites for hydropower plants. No, that's not true at all. There are tens of thousands of sites for little power plants. But you see, if you did that, you'd be competing with the big power plants. Now imagine this. What if we had so many little power plants all over the country that we produce twice as much electricity as we need? What would the value of electricity be worth if we were producing twice as much as we could use? Well, wouldn't the value of electricity be about half of what it is now? That's what the marketplace does. You see, when you take off government regulations, you eliminate monopoly. Government regulations are put on to promote monopoly. The big power companies go to Congress and they say, we don't want these little power plants running around. We don't want them because they depress the price of electricity. Now, that looks pretty self-serving when they do that. So what they do is they go out and they fund the Sierra Club and the environmental wackos. And the environmentalists, they go to Congress and say, we got to have wild and scenic rivers. So Congress turns around and says, okay, well, we'll make all of this off limits. We'll make these laws and regulations so that people can't put in these little power plants and we can't put in these dams because we want a shortage of electricity to keep the price high. We want a shortage of oil so that we can keep the price high. We don't want abundance. That's not good for the marketplace. Again, when you build too many hydro plants and the price of electricity drops in half, people will quit building little hydro power plants because they're not economical. Up until recently, I have not put in a solar power plant here on my farm because it wasn't economical. The other day, we did another study. Now, we did this study about 10 years ago. We just did a study the other day. And the study was 125 volts, cost $400. So a solar panel now is 125 watts for 80 bucks. It used to be about double that, and it wasn't quite economical the last time I checked. Now it's just about economical. So I'm going to do the ecological and environmentally friendly thing. I'm going to take myself off the grid, put in a solar power plant. I think I can put the numbers together and crunch them and make this thing work. And then whatever power that I'm using here, I will generate from the sun. I won't be a burden on anybody else. And then the hydropower that you've got out there that's available for everybody, instead of me taking my share, I'll leave my share there for you people. You people can share the shortage, and I'll have my abundance. How's that? I think that's fair. But this concept that you have to have one or the other, that hydropower has to take the place of oil, and it can't, and because it can't, this is an insoluble problem. I don't see that at all. What I would do if I was the central planning guru, I would stop burning oil and natural gas to generate electricity, and I would concentrate on generating electricity with tens of thousands of little hydropower plants all over the nation. And I think if government were to create the law that requires the power grid owners, that is, the White River Valley Electric Company, to tie my little steam power, wood power plant onto the grid, and then my neighbor over here who maybe has a creek and dams it up and it generates electricity and he turns that into the grid, I would generate all of my electricity, my neighbor would generate all of his electricity, and the surplus electricity, we put it on the grid, and then you people could use it in the city, you see, and there'd be so much power out there that it would depress the price of power. God, that'd be terrible, wouldn't it, if your power bill were cut in half? Be kind of like the computer industry. I can remember I paid $5,000 for a computer in 1982. $5,000 for a computer, and my boy tells me it's an antique. It's a piece of trash. And you can replace it today, he says, at Best Buy for $1,000 or less. Now, I can remember during World War II when we made a telephone call to my Uncle Carol in Orlando, Florida from Eureka, California. It cost $3.43, I believe it was, for 3 minutes. You'd call the operator, place the call. It took 20 minutes to make the connection. It was filled with static. It was a bad connection, bad call, and in those days we were making about, I think my granddad made $1.63 an hour during World War II. It cost $3.43 to make a phone call. Today, it costs 5 cents a minute, $3 an hour to talk long distance on the telephone. Isn't that terrible that the price of telephone communications has gone from a dollar a minute to a nickel? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with productivity? What's wrong with the realization of real profit? It's what gave us our standard of living, and government regulations are destroying it. Environmental wackos are taking it away. And it doesn't make any sense, does it? All right, let's take a look at coal. Coal. We have about 1,000 years worth of coal. Well, that's what the experts tell us. Out in the West, they've got coal seams 130 feet thick, 3 miles wide, and 60 miles long. They're so big that they've got earth-moving equipment out there. They load up trains, 109 railroad cars, 50 tons to a car, 100,000 pounds of coal, 50 tons, 109 of them. And there's four tracks wide on Highway 30, or next to Highway 30, and the Union Pacific Railroad coming across Nebraska now, out of Wyoming, across Nebraska, bringing all that coal out to all these power plants. Well, that's pretty good thinking. If we were trying to burn oil to generate all of that coal, we'd be wasting a lot of oil that could better be used to make gasoline with, don't you think? Well, listen to the story. As a replacement for oil, about 50% to 200% heavier than oil per energy unit, Dr. Thomas Mayer, the professor of physics and computer science at the University of California State University, in class notes that liquid fuels from coal, it has large pollution and environmental problems, an EPR of less than 8, it consumes 1 unit of energy to produce 8. Well, that sounds like a pretty good return to me. 8 to 1, divide 8 into 100, you get 16, don't you? Now, if you're taking a look at ethanol and they say that's environmentally friendly, it has a net loss to it. This coal, for every unit of energy that you use, you get 7 back. So it looks like a pretty good return to me. And then he says an EPR of less than 8. God, that's pretty good. Well, for instance, when you're pumping oil, it takes 17% of the oil to pump the 83% out that you net. Coal has a better return than oil when you have to pump it. All right, now going on, he says, conventional oil rapidly displaced the direct use of coal as an industrial and transport fuel because of its ease of storage and transport. The fine control possible in its various uses and its high power-weight ratio, oil is the most economically effective of all the fuels, especially for transport. Contemporary industries and services using coal, gas, and electricity require petroleum-powered transport to be economically effective and viable. The availability of cheap oil is the most critical factor for the future of our contemporary world. Well, now, if that's true, this cheap oil, why don't we keep oil cheap by not consuming all of the oil that we have? And why don't we concentrate on using more coal to generate more electricity? Now, let's think about this for a minute, because the environmentalists come along and says, oh, my God, that coal's terrible stuff. You know what? It pollutes the air. Well, I already pointed out, I don't know how much power could be produced by hydropower. But I pointed out that just in the 80-mile stretch from Atlanta to Boise, you could generate enough electricity for 250,000 people. How many rivers like the Boise River are there in Idaho? Well, there's several of those rivers. Several. And that power could be used, but you know, they took the Salmon River and they locked it up and they said, well, this is wilderness area. We can't make hydropower up here. Okay, let's let them have the Salmon River for wilderness area. Do you have to lock every river up for wilderness? Or could we take the rivers, creeks, and streams that are available to us right now? Even if those rivers, creeks, and streams don't produce hydropower 12 months a year, when the rivers and the creeks are running, we could be producing it just like wind power, couldn't we? And that would eliminate the burning of this coal, wouldn't it? Now stand by and we'll talk about the economic impact of not burning coal right after this. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax. A fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms, but what is it that the government does? To produce, prepare, or deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink. Does the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on a pizza that they buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and then pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? Now, why does the government get paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that we buy? Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, I said we take a look at the economic impact of that coal. Remember I told you there's four railroad tracks along Highway 30. Well, I went over along the railroad tracks and I parked and I watched the trains go by and I started counting them. That's why I told you there was 109 cars in each one of those trains. They're called captive trains. Three tracks wide. Every 15 minutes, there's a coal train going east, and a little more often than that, coming west on the one track, bringing the empty cars back up to reload. Now, I would imagine three tracks wide, a coal train every 15 minutes, that's 12 coal trains of 109 cars each, that's 1,300 cars plus every hour, 50 tons each. Now, we're burning a lot of coal in this country to generate electricity, and it's coming out of these giant coal seams up in Wyoming. They tell us we got 1,000 years worth of that coal, and they tell us we're going to run out of oil in the next 50 years. Well, my common sense tells me that we're going to have to burn a lot of coal, for at least for a while, until you can get these wind generators built and these solar panel operations built. And the big power companies are not going to build wind generators and solar power. Little guys might. I mean, you might get some little guys if you had legislation that said, you know, after all, we're practicing central planning, central government planning. If the government came along and said, okay, there's a rancher out in Colorado who's leasing space to the power company to put up these wind turbines. He gets paid for that. I imagine there's lots of ranchers and lots of people in Colorado that would rent space, probably put in their own wind generators and hook into the power grid to generate this electricity, which could take the place of this coal, couldn't it? Now, let's do that. Let's just tell the coal companies, shut off the spigot because we're going to put in wind and solar power and we don't want to burn your coal because it's dirty. See, that's what central planners do. They interfere with the marketplace. They're trying to make things better, but in reality, they just screw everything up. There's a better way. We got it from Moses. It's called strict liability. Here's what you do. If you're going to burn coal, you got to burn it without polluting the air. That's all. You just enact a law and you say, thou shalt not pollute the air. we've already got some of these laws on the books. It's just that nobody enforces them, I guess. I guess some of these power companies pay some fines, but let's try it this way. What if you said, look, you can burn all the coal you want as long as you don't emit more than this amount. And if you emit more than that amount, we'll shut you down and we'll let the little guys over here generate the power. How's that? I think that the marketplace would soon determine which is the better source of power, wind or coal. Instead of dictating to people what it is they shall burn or what they shall do, you simply set up the standards and say, if you can meet the standards, go cook. And if you can't meet the standards, then back off. And that'll give you the clean air that you're looking for. Of course, that isn't going to do very much for Los Angeles, where you're burning up all this gasoline and polluting the air. That's another problem for another day. But, you know, maybe we've got a solution on the way, hydrogen power. Remember, if you put in nuclear power plants, these big nuclear power plants might be the source of power or energy that we need to break the water down so that we can get the hydrogen out of the water so that we can burn that in our automobiles. Now, let's go to the oil companies and say, well, look, we're not going to consume all this oil, this trillion barrels of oil, burning up gasoline. We're going to make hydrogen, and we're going to do all these wonderful things, and you guys can't sell all this oil. See, the oil companies have a trillion barrels of oil, and they want to sell it tomorrow. Make all the money off of it, and who cares whether you've got any oil for next year or 5 years from now or 100 years from now. They're not concerned about that. They're just concerned with how much profit do we make today? Short-term profit. But if we wanted to dress and keep the garden, wouldn't we have to stretch that oil out? I mean, you know, if you're walking across the desert and you got a gallon of water, well, did you want to take a shower with it right now, or did you want to kind of husband the water and measure how much you drink every hour and make it last as long as possible? Well, my common sense says to me, since there's a finite amount of oil and we need that for lubricants and we need that for diesel fuel to run our locomotives and run our automobiles and so on, it would make more sense to me to go all out to develop all of the hydropower possible, all of the wind power possible, and forget about trying to get the big power companies to put in wind generators. Let little guys put in wind generators. Why not have 1,000 farmers put in one wind generator that generates 5,000 watts? And tie it into the grid. It's like I told you, you know, a little guy like me could make $50,000 a year. That would take me out of the marketplace for labor. Why, I would be employed full-time producing electricity, wouldn't I? Thousands of people could be employed full-time on their own little power generating operation, whether it's hydro, wind, steam from wood. Has anybody ever thought of that? Just let the marketplace take care of it. Take the regulators off of our backs and let us go to work. Now, that isn't going to happen, but I just wanted to point out that when you're freezing in the dark, there was a solution to the problem. Now, I'm going to solve my problem. I'm going to generate my own electricity. I thought about putting in a little wood power plant here, a steam wood power plant. The problem is that I don't want to spend all of my time stoking the fires. So I said, if I'm going to stoke the fire for myself, I might as well stoke the fire and make my living at it. If I could stoke the fire and make $50,000 a year off my own place, I could put in 100. That'd be one megawatt. Make $100,000 a year, and then buy wood from other guys, which would employ other people cutting firewood and burning the firewood in a steam power plant. I know some guy came along and said, oh, you got these emission controls. Well, okay. The more regulations that you want to put on me, let me ask you this. When you burn a forest down, when you burn up 2 million acres of forest, do you have emission controls? I mean, you know, you environmental wackos over there have your heads up the wrong end over here. You don't have any emission controls on forest fires, but you're complaining about George Gordon burning wood in a logical manner over here so that we can control, we can produce something that's intelligent. Electricity is number one. Do it economically, number two. Make a living, number three. And number four, then we could talk about, well, how about environmental controls or emission controls? What would we put on the smokestack? What is it that we need to filter out? And how can we do that economically? You know, and what we hear is, if you can't do that, well, then you can't produce electricity. Okay, so I don't. I'm not producing any electricity. And I'm not going to. I'm not going to fight with bureaucrats and fools. I don't have any duty to protect a fool from his folly. But I did read the articles here, and I said, well, gee, what's the solution to this? As I read through each one of these articles, they say they're just negative on everything. They're negative on coal, negative on hydroelectric, negative on nuclear. Positive on wind, positive on solar, positive on hydrogen, neutral on natural gas, negative on shale oil, and negative on wood, negative on coal. And we've got oil, and gosh, we've got to solve this oil problem. And I'm sitting here saying, well, I don't see that there's a problem in the marketplace. Central planners have a problem. Now listen to this. Large pollution and environmental problems. Coal burning produces a great deal of solid waste, 5 to 20% of the original volume. A single coal-fired electric plant can produce 1 million tons of solid waste a year. Oh, okay. Coal-fired generating stations are major sources of the particulates and ozone that make up smog, acid rain, greenhouse gases, and persistent toxins such as mercury. The Ministry of Environment has indicated, Ministry of Environment, that's the environmental police, estimated that the current levels of particulates in Ontario's air are associated with 1,800 premature deaths and 1,400 cardiac and respiratory hospital admissions in Ontario each year. Okay, did you get that? Burning coal in Ontario, Canada, produces 1,800 premature deaths and 1,400 cardiac and respiratory hospital admissions in Ontario every year. And the environmentalists are opposed to nuclear power that doesn't kill anybody. Now, what's going on here? Why are we opposed to nuclear energy? It's so efficient and has so much potential, and it can be done in big generating plants that the coal interests are opposed to it. My God, if you were mining all that coal out of Wyoming and somebody comes along and says, look, we can eliminate, you know, all of these thousands of carloads of coal that's burning and making all this particulate matter going into the air, all this sulfur and mercury, we can eliminate that problem by putting in nuclear power. They don't want that. The oil interests don't want that. The natural gas interests don't want that. And so they've succeeded in shutting down nuclear power. Furthermore, tens of thousands of little guys like George Gordon generating electricity over here, we don't want that. That would eliminate all those coal trains. See what your problem is, boys and girls? So on the one hand, you've got people running around saying, God, we're just really for the environment. And we want wind power and we want solar power. They're liars. They don't want wind or solar. They don't want hydrogen. They don't want anything that competes with the status quo. That's where reality's at. So the environmentalists have a good plan. They have a good idea. They just haven't thought it through well enough to bring it to fruition. The solution is through the free marketplace. The solution is you open up the marketplace and you let little guys by the thousands compete with the coal interests. You let little guys like George Gordon and thousands like me put in little hydro plants, little steam-powered wood-burning plants, and little wind generator plants. I'm not so sure that the solar power plants make a lot of economic sense, but maybe they would. For instance, we figured here that for $40,000, we could generate enough electricity throughout the year to run 5,000 watts a day. Now, that's 5 kilowatts a day per year, year-round. Well, that takes a lot more investment than a wind generator. It takes a lot more investment than a steam power plant. And maybe if the numbers were crunched, maybe that might. Little operators. Now, big power companies, they're not going to do that. They're talking about putting in a big coal-fired plant up here in Springfield. See, Springfield is a city of about 150,000, and they're at their capacity, and they're having to buy power from other sources, and so they're figuring, well, we'll build another big power plant up here. And they're talking about the pollution that goes along with it. You know, it's like pigs. They want to put 10,000 sows in one big operation, you know, on 10 acres. Why don't you take the same 10,000 sows and put them on 10,000 acres? That's one pig per acre. There's no pollution with one pig per acre. But 10,000 pigs on 10 acres, 1,000 pigs per acre, now that creates a lot of pollution. Why don't we think about decentralization? And instead of trying to centralize this coal-fired power plant in Springfield, why don't we decentralize the power among hundreds or thousands of little guys over here and produce the same amount of power and spread it over a larger area? Has anybody ever thought of that? Well, believe it or not, we used to do that in the United States, and in the early days, cities used to generate their own power. They would produce their own power in various ways. And then somebody came along and said, well, gee, why don't we centralize this? Why don't we buy these little guys out and centralize these into monopolies? And that's what they've done. And of course, you people in Los Angeles and Chicago, you don't care. All you're concerned about is my $30 a month or $100 a month power, the amount of power that I use. You're not interested in putting in $40,000 to build a power plant for your own house. But hey, listen, all of us farmers out here, all of us ranchers can do that. I told you about the guy here that produced biodiesel, and the Japanese came up with a machine, a press where you could press out your own diesel fuel and run your own tractor. That's called biodiesel, and the U.S. government outlawed it. They can't sell it in the United States because it competes with Exxon and Mobil. We don't want that. Furthermore, you farmers out there would be producing your own sunflowers, producing your own biodiesel, burning it in your pickups as well as your tractors, and you wouldn't be paying any road use taxes. We can't have that. So what we'll do is we'll just ban it and buy all of our diesel fuel from the Arabians, and then we'll pay the Arabians with our dollars and create a balance of payments deficit that we can't afford. Does that make any sense to anybody? I can't see any sense to that. Now, there's another factor here on coal. Did you know that you can make liquid fuel from coal? Now, they've got a little blurb here. It says, liquid fuels from coal, Steve Morning Thunder, Institute de Fiesta, Universidad, I guess that's the University of Mexico, quoting Energy Strategies Toward a Solar Future, Union of Concerned Scientists, 1980. The Germans developed that gasification of coal to turn it into liquid. It's not very economical. Nobody wants to do it as long as you can dig a hole in the ground and bring 1,600 pound per square inch oil out of the ground under pressure. I mean, after all, I can understand the logic behind that. But the bottom line is that we're running out of oil. So if we're running out of oil and we're going to practice central planning, then doesn't your common sense tell you that some central planner somewhere has to say, we got to conserve on that oil and use more of this over here? Well, that's what I do here. You know, when I've got more oats than I've got wheat, or if I've got more hay or more grass hay than I've got alfalfa hay or something, you know, then I have to use what I've got. And a little businessman, you know, doesn't have a real hard time figuring out how to use what he's got. But when you have these giant monopolies and they're competing for their market share, you know, coal wants its market share of energy, oil wants its market share of energy, and they'll work together to put some other energy form out of business. But you know, if you're going to have central planning, there's no reason why you can't use coal, oil, nuclear, hydro, wind, solar, hydrogen, natural gas, shale oil, and wood, and use them where it's most logical to use them. It doesn't make sense to use wood out in the middle of Nebraska and Kansas where there aren't any trees, but it makes all the sense in the world to use wood for home heating in rural areas, in forest areas, where there's plenty of wood and it's just being used to fuel forest fires, for crying out loud. You know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out now, do you? Let's take a look at solar and wind power. Now, this surge in solar sales comes as current data shows solar energy makes up less than 1% of global power supplies. I'm surprised that solar energy makes up 1% of the world's energy supplies. But that's a great start in the right direction, doesn't it? Gee, if 1% of the energy, it makes up less than 1, but you know, it's probably around 7/10 or 8/10 of 1% or something like that. If we can produce 1% of our energy from the sun, well, then if we double that, we could produce 2%. And if we double that, we could produce 4%. And if we double that, we could do 8%. Well, look, about the time that you're producing 10% of your electrical energy from the sun, that's 10% less than you have to burn oil and coal, isn't it? Now, is it economical? I don't think it's economical. At least it's not economical in the minds of big megawatt California Edisons or a New York Edison power company. They don't want to hear that kind of crap. But you know, some little guy like me, or 100 or 1,000 little guys like me, could probably put in a little solar plant, plug it in to the power grid, and make some money off of it. I'm not opposed to that, so if you environmentalists think, well, that Gordon, you know, he's some kind of a nut. He's one of those polluters. Oh, no, I'm not. I'm a better steward of my land here than most of you people out there, most of you environmentalists who live in the cities and don't know what you're talking about anyway. Now, I'm tuned in to protecting my land from erosion. I'm kind of tuned into selective harvesting of trees so that I don't waste my forest land here. I'm tuned into that. Going on here, the new wind turbines added in 1998 have pushed overall wind generating capacity worldwide to 9,600 megawatts at the end of this year, double the capacity in place just 3 years earlier. These wind turbines will generate roughly 21 billion kilowatt hours of electricity in 1999. That's enough for 3.5 million suburban homes. Wind power is now the world's fastest growing energy source. And I pointed that out to you, and I think that I read a story here. I'll share the story with you. The guy in Colorado, he's got, 13,000 acres, I think it was. And the power company came out there and leased sites. He can run his cattle, and these wind turbines, they don't take up very much room. They got to have roads to each one of them so that they can get to them and service them, you know, and take care of them. So they get roads all over his place, and they pay him money. He makes more money now off of the wind generators than he does off of his cattle ranching. Now, I say that's pretty good business. Now, I'm a farmer. Now, we don't have any wind here where I live. That's too bad we don't, because I'd like the power company to come in here and put up wind turbines and generators so that my cows could eat and I could raise my cows and make money generating power. I wouldn't have any objection to that. And I can tell you right now, thousands of landowners all over America do the same thing. But, hey, listen, what about these guys that are producing all this coal? Yeah, you know, all those train loads of coal that are coming down? Every time that you put up one of these wind generators, you're taking a railroad car of coal out of the mouths of Peabody Coal Company or Union Pacific Railroad. They don't want that. Now, as far as central planners are concerned, I think it's a great idea. After all, it's renewable, and they're pretty ugly. I mean, you're out there on the landscape, and you look at them out there, they're pretty ugly on the landscape. I can't see anything that has any redeeming value to them, but it's a whole lot better. It's kind of like putting a dam across the river. You know, it's better than freezing to death in the dark, isn't it? Going on, Paul Ehrlich is a professor of population studies at Stanford University, and Howland Ehrlich is a senior research associate in biology and associate director of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford. Photovoltaic solar panels cost $4 per watt. Average wholesale price for a solar module in 1995. Well, I just pointed that out. 125 watts is about, let's just do this, it's $400 divided by 125 is $3.2, $3.20 per kilowatt, or per watt, rather, not kilowatt, but per watt. Well, that's quite a little improvement. And I'm sure that as time progresses along, that we could probably get that down even more. That's good thinking. But you know, these technologies that you hear the government's financing, like generating electricity from the tides. Well, do you think that the big power companies that are generating power now from coal and oil and natural gas want to hear about that? You know, once you put one of those power plants in, there's no more coal to sell. There's no more oil or natural gas to sell. That's good for the generators, but it's not good for the energy suppliers. So as long as you've got that problem, that's a political problem. As long as you've got that political problem and you've divorced that from the marketplace, you're not going to make any progress. Well, I'm about out of time. We got one more program to do, and we'll cover hydrogen. Now, that hydrogen, I think, has some real value to it. The numbers tell me that. And then there's food production, and delivery depends upon oil. You know, all these chemical fertilizers that we put on, chemical fertilizers come from oil. Well, we're not going to practice land Sabbaths and jubilees, and as long as we don't practice the biblical law, then I guess the only other alternative is chemical fertilizer. And if that's the case, then we need the oil, if for nothing else, to feed ourselves with. Seems like to me that the oil for chemical fertilizer and sprays and pesticides is a whole lot more important than generating electricity, wouldn't you think? Would you rather eat, or would you rather be able to starve to death in bright light? All right, keep in mind that The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do that 7 days a week. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. All right. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we're just about out of time. We'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station. There's the signal says my time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friend.